Okay, what's the long-term effects of the TA strike on the math department? Whether in fact there are any effects which we can say came from the TA strike rather than from other circumstances? Answer is, today we are, there are a few long-term effects. I think we are more acutely conscious that we relied over much on the TA system during the 60s, turned too much teaching over to TAs. That remains a consciousness that we've been unable to do much about, because every time we find a way to lessen TA involvement and increase faculty involvement, we get an additional 500 students and wind up with just as much TA involvement as before. And we respond, if we get 500 students, maybe we'll be able to respond to 100 of those 500 with faculty, and we then have to respond to the other 400 TAs.
Now, you don't have enough. I thought the math department was overstaffed, and I would think that you'd be able to put more of your faculty on to beginning teaching.
The department is very comfortable with teaching calculus and post-calculus, with having its faculty teach calculus and post-calculus courses, and it is very uncomfortable with having faculty heavily involved with teaching pre-calculus courses.
This, you mean people don't want to do it?
Right, and this a typical faculty member regards as not what he signed on for, really. Mm-hmm. Not what a college professor is supposed to be doing. College mathematics, as in our minds, begins properly with calculus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, the way we were all brought up, the way our own college experience went. That probably is the major reason for the depth of this feeling. That's the way we were brought up. So that, and all our, well, almost all of our enrollment increases since 1968 have come at the pre-calculus level. When actually what would be a nice and comfortable enrollment growth in calculus, there have been some zigs and zags there due to changing college requirements, which have knocked calculus enrollments down for a while, but the long-term trend is for something like a 3-5% growth in calculus, reflecting the increased use of mathematics at that level by all other departments on campus.
Is, I should find this out myself, is calculus or a math course required for all students or just?
No.
Is it an alternative to?
For many parts of the campus, it's possible to come here and with the admission requirement of 2 years of high school math and never take another math course. LNS students have a requirement of 3 units of mathematics, which is either the units a year of high school or a semester of college. A lot of them are admitted with 2 units and have to make up 1 unit here.
I should think if that institutional loyalty, if the math department is overstaffed, as I understand, because it was so heavily added to in the 60s, would suggest that people would consent to teach some of these early courses. Does it not work that way?
It works that way, but that depth of feeling doesn't run deep enough and far enough people to keep pace with the increase in pre-calculus enrollments. And it really, that's the case primarily of departmental loyalties. That's the institution we're talking about. We talk about institutional loyalties. This feeling that, yes, indeed, math instruction is the business of the math departments. If the students have to have instruction before calculus, then it's our business to provide for that instruction. That exists is a reason why for some people to teach at that level.
So there are some who are willing to do it.
Right.
We do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it's.
But it's not. You can't force them to because they can say, I wasn't hired to do that, I'm not
The entire University of Wisconsin administration goes through life trying to avoid deciding what it can force faculty to do.
Would it if it could?
Would it force...
So that you wouldn't have to get extra TAs and hire extra instructors?
Let's say everybody is conscious in some general sense that it would be desirable to have fewer TAs and more faculty, and that having more faculty teaching pre-calculus courses is the logical way to do this, and that response hasn't caused so many people to come forward and saying, I perceive all that I've just talked about, and I'm going to respond to it by myself volunteering to teach. It hasn't caused enough people to do that to make it easy to staff these courses with faculty. So in that sense, they aren't doing it.
But nobody's tapping anyone on the shoulder and saying, look, just take this course for this semester, no matter how you feel about it.
Not to a great extent. We do assign people a discussion section of, say, Math 112, which is 11th, 12th grade algebra, from time to time, tell them, look, that's your course, and they say, right on, I'll do it. That isn't where we actually need them. There's just no way that we are going to replace TAs head-on with faculty. We have to, if we're going to do it, find ways to give the faculty more leverage than the TA has. The faculty has to be responsible for more students than the TA is. To replace TAs by faculty. And it's not that there's difficulty in getting a faculty member to replace a TA head on, to say that lecture one of Math 112 will be taught by a faculty member. It's a difficulty in getting faculty to sit down and design mechanisms of where faculty have more leverage and can be responsible for more students, and then to commit themselves to working those two. There's where we're hard put to it to find the faculty. And this, you know, this is not just a case of somebody taking a course for a semester. This is a case of somebody taking responsibility for an awful lot of students for perhaps a period of a couple of years. And that is the question that, when we say volunteers take one step forward, nobody, or very few people, are stepping. They don't want to volunteer that much of a commitment for themselves on what they regard as something that, even if it's our responsibility, still a responsibility that, if the world were run right, we would not have. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the outcome of that is going to be. The university as a whole is fussing with this problem of remedial instruction. We gave up the word remedial because of the bad vibes, but I don't know a better word to replace it with.
Any word will have bad vibes eventually.
Once people catch on, right? Mm. It's like euphemisms for toilets.
Mm.
Of course, we also have it's not just the realization from the strike that we had basically created a sub-department of TAs that's now present in our minds, but the realization that what we have is all these TAs who are teachers in training, and then no teacher jobs for them to go to, and so maybe you could. So, if these TAs are to have a shot at a academic job after they get out, all the colleges in the country will have to be involving recent PhDs in education, and the place where we have the big need is in these pre-calculus courses. We have so far refused to create a two-tier faculty in which we would have junior people who taught pre-calculus and senior people who taught calculus.
I wonder why not.
Because we think that's a mopey way to live. And we feel that both as a very naive perception, but here are these recent PhDs who are just as good mathematicians as the senior people, though at an earlier stage of their career, and ought not be in every aspect of their lives subjected to second bests just because they're younger. And as a practical matter, those who think about practical matters, if you were to follow that road for certain immediate conveniences, you'd just be recreating the TA problem with a different group of people. You take a bunch of people and say you are a second-class faculty, well, then there's going to be tensions and unhappiness. So both of those come. Well, and I guess a third fact, if we create a second-class faculty for people that we think are not us but them, will all our university administration agree that with the line we have drawn and say, yes, indeed, you guys are us and get the good side, and those guys are them and get the bad side? Or will they say, can't we slightly increase the number of people taking the bad side? So
Is this the sort of thing that's been amply discussed and put into faculty meeting minutes? And
our minutes hardly ever contain the discussion. Mm. We take it up at department meetings, but there's not been a progression of discussion, despite the fact it's come up at department meetings every year since 1970. We begin at the same point every year. As far as the department meeting goes, administrative types, you know, try and make a progression. We haven't got a big 5-year plan which everybody would be caught up in and which would carry them along so that they would be progressing intellectually on us.
That's the great problem with TAs and students, isn't it? That you keep replacing. How the TA strike affected the department and
right, so it's made us feel that we should strive for more faculty involvement and less TA involvement in undergraduate instruction. Without our external factors have prevented us from accomplishing very much in this line. We will never have quite the same. Well, while these people who were involved in the strike still live, never have quite the same feeling that we really are one big happy family. I said that we didn't think of the department as one big family in anywhere like the way that other departments might have, but so we certainly didn't think of ourselves as a nuclear family. Perhaps we thought of ourselves as an extended family, you know, with all kinds of cousins counted in. And since the strike, still like to think of ourselves that way, but we always will have a realization, I think both faculty and TAs, that this may not be the case. This may just be an amiable fiction. It's, of course, living with a contract has made some differences. You do indeed now have to be prepared to stand and deliver before a third party on all your important statements to TAs. And this has meant that we talk more, tend to say more of the same thing regardless of what quarters we're in, because of the knowledge that, as a matter of fact, it may all be brought together in an extreme case and an arbitration case. And I think this actually has been a very salutary outcome of the strike. If we could avoid about 80% of the whole bit of a union in the strike, the 20%, which says that people have to be prepared to stand judgment on their statements, that is a very salutary thing to get out of a union.
I mean, statements in regard to length of employment and salary,
yeah,
and that
right.
sort
so
of thing.
That's that sort of thing, and indeed just an evaluation of students.
Mm.
Sometime before the strike, I was looking at some TA folder and found a note from some faculty member saying, frankly, this guy is not the kind of person we should be giving a TA to, he's a rotten student. And I went and looked at the class list, and this TA had as high a grade as was given in that particular section of 20 students. The faculty member was trying to talk out of two sides of his mouth. When he knew the student was looking, he was prepared to assign the A. When he thought the student wasn't looking, he was giving a different evaluation. And this didn't go much further than I've said. There's been, you know, a lot of TA anxiety about really horrible discrepancies where a faculty member would tell ATA, you're number one with me, kid, and then writes letters of recommendation saying, frankly, this guy is rotten and stinks, and you know, you should try and put him in jail if possible. Never is a large word. I would be stupid to say that, you know, of all the 70 faculty people that I know dealing with all the graduate students who have gone through here, that's never occurred, but I don't think that, I think that if it ever did occur anything that even remotely approached that, it would be a very isolated and weird and freakish incident.
Well, which side has lost out on this? The candor and the recommendation, or the high grade?
Each is given a little. There's a meeting in the middle. It is harder to get an honest evaluation than, well, let's see. It's harder to get a frank evaluation than it used to be. I switched from the word honest to frank. I think people are perhaps a little more thoughtful about their evaluations than they used to be because of feeling that they are more subject to challenge. So you lose a little on the frankness, but you start with a little better evaluation to begin with. Evaluations that they give the students have shaded downward a little bit as the evaluations they give to other people have shaded upwards. It's all meeting at some middle points. I'm sure that there are still people who, still faculty members who, I'm sure actually it's even I, who am, you know, deeply involved in administration, typically leave a student feeling slightly better about the result of an interview than I really intended, because it's a very human thing to try and accentuate the positive and to think of, think of those things, number one, those things which are genuinely current strengths, number two, those things which are potential strengths if only a person could work a little bit on. And those are the parts that come out when you're talking to somebody, and the parts about, if you need to work on X, then you aren't as good as you could be in X, and here are some other things that I never mentioned at all, where I have no faith you'll ever be any good, to try and skip rather lightly over those in an interview. So there is certainly still some disparity, but I think now a very minimal one. I think it was good for the university administration, even from a faculty point of view, that they had to stand and deliver to TAs on what they said. I still feel, as a faculty member in talking to higher administrators, that from time to time one goes in and you have to discuss a topic, and you make your pitch from your side of the topic, and the guy you're talking to makes his pitch from his side of the topic, and then he sits back and judges the two arguments and decides that basically his argument was the better. And which a third party might not, after having heard the two arguments. I think there's a little less of that than there used to be before. And in fact, there's quite a good deal less of really rather forced and strained arguments. Yeah, we're a bunch of clever people around here, and if a guy endeavors to prove a point to you by telling you about what happened in Germany in 1500, and it turns out you know that subject and can confute him there, he can always come back and tell you about the Samoans, and nobody's ever going to have enough energy to refute all the plausible arguments that any clever person around here can think of. The reliance on that fact as a way of settling difficulties, I think, is slightly less now that we're living in a more arms-length sort of situation. Not an arms-length sort of situation, a situation where there's more third-party review.
It's a very interesting observation.
Right, and I hope that we can manage to latch on to the good of this. We're always being third-party to death with the Department of Administration and in the TA case, you know, there are a lot of disadvantages to having to tell your story to an arbitrator who doesn't, you know all that much about a university and student discipline cases, same problems. And having the federal government come in and talk affirmative action or Buckley amendments, they're the same problems. You lose a lot on this, but you do gain something in terms of having to look at your actions, not with that nice sympathetic point of view which you would like to accord yourself, but for a more realistic one. In my wildly optimistic moments, I hope that these effects will counterbalance all that we're losing on this.
Is considerable also, I know.
Right, but so those are, you know, the things that I think of as coming out of the strike. They aren't terribly great. It's not a wildly different department. I think, you know, if you had sat a guy down for a week in this department in 65, 66, and told him to you know, go and listen to people talking on the ninth floor and do the same thing in 75, 76, he would not come back saying, my goodness, there's a real difference that seems to have something to do with the TA strike somewhere. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't, I don't think, be conscious.
Would there be a difference that didn't have to do with the TA strike?
There would... yeah, if he was listening closely, he would discover a difference which mostly has to do with the job situation, with our perceptions of where mathematics fits into the whole country's story, 65-66, Kennedy years. Intelligence and technology are going to reshape the country, and mathematics is a leader in the 75-76. Heavens knows what's going to reshape the country, but whatever it is, mathematics is not going to be an obvious and evident
medium. Really? Is that...
yeah, that's sure. Everybody feels that this is a slightly bizarre result, that we live in a more technological society now than a decade ago. Our need for more bright ideas is much... we perceive our need for ideas more strongly than we did in 65-66. In 65-66, we thought we'll just turn the valve wider on the oil tanks and solve all our problems that way, and now we all know that we cannot do that if we're going to provide for 2075. There's going to have to be a lot of cleverness and not so much fossil resources, but it is quite clear that although we have this as a perception of, you know, how we have to get to 2075, it's also quite clear we're not moving in that direction now, we're moving in a contrary direction.
But the mathematicians are not going to be the ones who are... You feel left out of it at this point. Is that what you're saying? That you're not... mathematics doesn't have such a crucial role as it was perceived to have.
It doesn't have the symbolic role that it had at that time. You know, the actual, what people were doing with mathematics, they're using more now than they did then. Academics are using more than they did then, but not very much more. Yeah, that's a case of, in 65, 66, we thought that suddenly around 70, all the pieces are going to fall into place. I'm now speaking in terms of wild hyperbole, but more or less the intellectual fairy was going to finally wave the magic wand and everybody would say yes, yes. Spend 20 years studying, every student should study math for 20 years, physics for 20 years, and then deduce. Spend the rest of their life deducing the answers to all possible questions. Some idea like that was in everybody's subconscious, and of course, it sounds damn stupid. One of the points about a subconscious is even very clever people can have very stupid ideas as long as they keep them down there. These ideas do, in some third and fourth order way, influence how they behave. Over the course of 20 years, third and fourth order effects are more important than the first order effects. These are the effects, that tell you how you get from today to tomorrow. It's a little like the bit about if you're lost in the woods, people will tend to go around trees more on the left than on the right, and therefore finally wind up in a circle, going around in a circle. That's a case of second-order effects finally predominating over first-order effects.
You're losing me.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Well, if all these tapes were terribly coherent, they'd be no fun to people listen to. But the federal government in 65-66 was saying more research contracts, more traineeships, more scholarships, more institutes, more centers of excellence, more science. So that's 65-66. 75-76, they're keeping a low profile. 72-73, they were saying research applied to national needs. They were saying social problems first. There's, on the subconscious level, technology got very implicated with the war in Vietnam. I think largely as a result of historical accident that we got into the war. The war in Vietnam's a Kennedy legacy, just as all this intellectual jazz is a Kennedy legacy. And I think with that in their heads, if people then do see somebody designing an automatic battlefield, and they say, aha, I knew it. Technology equals Vietnam War. And even today, I think people have this feeling.
Well, why did the math department, as I have a record that there was a 23-4 vote. Well, how could that be in the math department against censoring MRC? Do you know anything about that? Doesn't seem the right proper number, does it?
Right, I don't, I'm not sure if I recall a specific equation on the occasion. The question why 23 plus 24 makes 27, and I've been talking about 70, where are all the other people? Possibly sitting in the room and not voting at all, or possibly not in the room.
But you do remember that that's happening.
I have a vague recollection that.
I think the seven graduate students or TAs had asked for a censure.
Right, something that was around 1970, was it? 73. Now, my recollection is terribly vague. I don't even recall what type of motion we were voting on at that time. Obviously, if the departmental administration had done its job, we weren't actually voting on a motion that had effect. We were taking a straw poll of some sort, or a record of sentiments. And if the department administration indeed succeeded in getting that to be the votes, most of the, then I can tell you where most of the other people were. They were saying this is all a lot of nonsense, and I don't want to go and listen to a lot of TAs talk nonsense, even for the pleasure of voting one way or the other.
Oh, I see. So.
And so those 23 would be a few good citizens who feel that they should participate, and a few people who are really quite concerned about MRC and who wanted to make sure it wound up on the right end of the boat, and that's who they are. Everybody else was doing their math in the office. And mathematicians do not like going to meetings, and they do not like, with very few exceptions, making speeches at meetings and parliamentary maneuvering. They just plain don't find that a form of recreation. And, if they can manage to avoid going to a meeting, they will. And they don't like rhetoric. They don't like rhetoric as much as other people. Another reason it's no fun for them to go to meetings.
Do they share this with the sciences, or do you think they're really out by themselves?
I think it is a factor present throughout all the sciences, but perhaps more in math than in many of the sciences.
You, when we were parting last time, expressed an interest in the question of language requirements.
Right. And these have even been battles we have fought concurrently, or, you know, issues we have argued, that's is a better way of putting it, concurrently with all these other issues. There have also been issues with some polarization attached.
But you want to talk about it then?
Well, let's see. What's there to be said about language requirements? Certainly, when people of my age were graduate students, there was no question about the need for mathematicians to be able to read mathematics in their own, other people's languages, because that's where 9/10 of all the mathematics was. When I was in college, there weren't any decent textbooks in English beyond about the sophomore or junior level, certainly not for graduate courses. We had to study out of Bourbaki, for instance, in French. And the situation changed quite dramatically from that period to the mid-60s. And has remained stable since then, with something like, I don't know, maybe 70-80% of all publication being in English. Yet we still do have a requirement of 2 foreign languages for the PhD. It's a requirement which people in the foreign language departments would say wasn't a requirement at all, because it's a requirement that a student be able to read mathematical exposition with the aid of a dictionary, and they would say, but that doesn't amount to knowing a language, and indeed, our students, none of them could read a newspaper, essentially none, in any of the languages they passed here.
Don't they have to pass the standard test in the language that the other graduate students do?
No, there aren't any standard tests anymore.
Oh, there aren't?
Right, there is, you know, Educational Testing Service has a test which people are welcome to use, but somewhere in the latter 60s, the graduate school essentially bowed out of the foreign language requirement business and told departments both the form of the requirements and the form of the tests thereafter be a departmental option. And that was a time at which there was a lot of student interest in having the math departments take advantage of that and cut its foreign language requirements.
Mm-hmm. And did it?
No. We had long discussions and debates on that score and concluded that the general sentiment was that students still should learn reading knowledge of two languages other than English, because even though the bulk of the publication was in English, there were still crucial articles in every field which were not available in English. It's not guaranteed, therefore, if a person does two languages, that he's going to be able to read all the crucial articles, because there are French, German, and Russian are very definitely major mathematical languages, and there's a certain amount in Italian, and then scatterings in all, well, another 20 languages.
Aren't these rapidly translated if they're important?
Well, there is a reasonable amount of translation, but it's nowhere as big an effort as it is in the sciences. There's a lot more money in translating other people's work in, say, solid-state physics than there is in translating other people's work in mathematics. Mm-hmm. And for obvious reasons, there's a lot more chance of getting money back in the short run.
Yeah.
So, although, you know, you can now get, for instance, many of the Russian journals in translation, you can't get all of them. So the translations don't really quite meet the problem. It did take us a long time, because it is not just an obvious open and shut case as to what the right thing is, and it does take time out of a student's life. And a group theorist would much rather have his students studying group theory than studying French or German, but we nonetheless felt the balance lay for keeping language requirements as they were. And it was actually a lucky shot that the graduate school had put the responsibility for administering these things in the mathematics department's hands, because that meant that our requirement does indeed mean exactly that you can read mathematical literature with a dictionary, which is what you're going to have to do in later life. Had it been left in graduate school hands, it would have meant something else. Something that mathematicians would have felt was over requirements, and had that been the requirement we were debating, I'm pretty certain that the outcome would have been the other way. It would have said, well, requirements, we don't fully believe in this form of the requirement, we're doubt, you know, the validity of the requirement is at least arguable, and so let's be popular with our students and vote the requirement out.
So what do you require of them now? I mean, how can they pass the language requirement?
The language exams are given several times a year, and every time they're given, a guy in charge of the exam goes around and finds exposition of only moderate difficulty in some textbook, math textbook, and cuts out about four paragraphs. And the student sits down with that in the dictionary and spends, I forget whether it's an hour or 2 hours, and produces a translation. If it's an accurate translation, he's then done that foreign language. And if it isn't, he hasn't. And
individualistic matter, isn't it?
Right. We have a student who had completed all the requirements for the PhD save German. That means, in particular, he had written the thesis, and the thesis was acceptable to everybody. He made a very serious challenge and said, I flat out am not going to take the German exam. You should give me the PhD anyway. And we had a portion of a department meeting devoted solely to him. And that was the real critical test. And we decided we were very sorry, but he wasn't going to get a PhD. So he doesn't have one to this day. The debates sucked in people's feelings about students and their desire to cut a good figure in front of students, as well as a lot of other things. So if you knew how somebody stood on MRC, you'd be halfway to knowing how he stood on a language requirement, and vice versa. all because of being mediated through this question of what kind of figure you're getting before students. You wouldn't be more than halfway, but you'd be halfway. And that's been one of the reasons why all my department administration spend all their time trying to keep stirring emotional debates about things like MRC out of the department as much as possible. They bloody well do slop over into things like language requirements. So if you really get a department nicely polarized on MRC, you will probably find it nicely polarized on all academic issues as well. And that is never going to lead to a sensible resolution of any academic issue where we, in fact, have some chance of being sensible. The point of view of all the people who have been administering the department is let's put our efforts on being sensible on mathematics and mathematics instruction, because we do have a chance there, and by gosh, if we can't be sensible there, then we aren't going to be sensible anywhere, and we might as well pack it in. And, it's not very easy to be sensible even on these topics.
Sounds to me as if you must have some very sensible administrators. I mean, I should imagine it must be a great temptation to some chairman to, or they are so constituted that they would create a polarization, would bring an issue into the forefront. Of
well, the ethos of the mathematics department is against that.
Do you think it's different from the other departments? Again, I ask.
Well, certainly our whole story is different from other departments. The English department, for instance, as near as I can judge from a distance, was quite seriously polarized at one time. It's, of course, appears to me to be an example of stable equilibria. This is a case of, you know, having a lumpy table which has peaks and valleys on it, and you can rest a little ball on a peak and it will sit there. You can rest it in the valley, it will sit there. But if you put it on a slope, it's going to roll. And if you manage to be on a peak and can keep from moving very far, it's not very hard to stay on a peak. If you move far, then you're going to roll down into a different situation. And it will take a tremendous amount of work to move yourself back up to that peak again. And with regards to avoiding polarization, we are in this happy situation of being on a peak, having avoided it, and
consciously too, evidently.
Excuse me.
You've done it consciously. You've avoided it consciously.
Yeah. Well, we've made efforts to avoid it, and because we started with a good situation, the efforts we've been able to make have sufficed. If something, if we'd been kicked hard enough by external events, we probably would have been.
Structure
how it came about.
They hadn't been aware of how it came out. It was purely a sort of weasel clause is a strictly worded clause, which might mean much, it might mean little. Presumably, the people who negotiated it talked the AA down from something which had a definite meaning to something which was ambiguous and felt, well, obviously, if they were willing to settle for this weak version, they don't really mean it. But the fact that it's gone from the other extreme of thinking that there was no such a thing is suddenly being defined in this clause. And there was also, it's not entirely clear to all faculty how deeply committed the administration was to flexible faculty control in these areas. And occasionally, administrators, both in that day and in this, get some bright educational idea and come around and tell people, we've got this great new program. You ought to fall in line and do something about it. Many people, the Institute for Environmental Studies is an instance of this. At that time, there was a potential program to retrain Vietnam veterans. That was a gleam in somebody's eye. It was going to be the hardest thing since the foundation of the University of Chicago. Well, it makes faculty nervous. We had this meeting, and Dick Buck and his department was persuaded not to actually move a stern motion on the floor.
Excuse me.
You've done it consciously. You've avoided it consciously.
Yeah. Well, we've made efforts to avoid it, and because we started with a good situation, the efforts we've been able to make have sufficed. If we'd been kicked hard enough by external events, we probably would have been kicked off that situation, and the kind of efforts we made would no longer have been adequate. We would have become polarized, and once you're polarized, it's hard to get yourself depolarized again.
You sound very much like a mathematician talking. I haven't heard anybody else talk in this way. And I begin to think perhaps as a consequence of analyzing things in math, you're able to
do it. And then mathematicians are talking about, you know, the non-applied area of mathematics. They say what Kant said, it's a mode of perception. In certain areas it is. This bit about equilibria is, in a way, a mode of perception. In fact, if you've been reading about catastrophe theory in Newsweek or somewhere like that, that is just a jumped up version of the same question of equilibria, sudden changes. It may be that this will become a useful mode of perception of general social problems springing from a mathematical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of a standing wave is a useful mode of perception, which anybody could see if they go and look at a stream, but a mathematician is much more likely to see because he studied standing waves in a stream. And there you see, you know, a wave in the surface of the stream, and the contour of the wave is fixed, but the water which makes up the wave is rushing through it. And much of sociology is just like this. You have generations rushing along, and yet, though the individuals move, society as a whole remains the same. It's an insight which can be useful in understanding things, which is more likely to occur to a mathematician.
Because we've had two mathematicians as deans recently. Do you think there's been any?
Right. Mathematics department has felt terribly abused by both of them.
Oh, Ingram too?
Yes, and I think perhaps with more reason in Ingram's case than with Laney's.
Was this a question of leaning over backwards not to protect
your
own department?
I think so. I think Ingram has really internalized that very deeply. I think he was just finishing being dean at the start of the 60s, and I think he'd had a very cautious view about expanding the math department and so on, which perhaps has made a minor contribution to our having gotten so deep in hoc to the TA system by the end of the 60s. One of the reasons was that we'd been very cautious about expanding at the beginning of the 60s, and the TA system took up the slack. Of course, it's also the case that, speaking of Clancy, who I really dealt with, if I ever thought that Clancy was in any way coming down on the math departments, I immediately rushed up and down the street crying, "Steve Clancy is being very hard on the math departments," because I'm sure that he knew and I knew, although we never discussed it, that if people in different departments can't see mathematicians doing that, they're going to draw unfavorable conclusions. So it's almost necessary that a mathematician be doing it, and therefore the time to do it is, you know, the first time the screw is turned, rather than forcing the poor fellow to really squeeze you before you yell.
So did it work?
Well, we survived. Who knows whether it worked. One, mathematicians won't be found eating lunch in the university club very much, so they never really know what's going on around here. All part of the
rabbit. It's one of our standard questions is the university club, but I've more or less stopped asking it because it disappeared so completely in the 60s. It's a question for the older faculty members,
right?
Because its decline is a big factor, many people think.
Right, well, that must signal the gross change in the university. You can still see members of the older generation all eating lunch down there. At least I've been in the place for some years now, and I would only go in for some kind of meeting, which caught me in there. Every time I was in for a meeting, I would see the same group of people.
We're almost, again, almost at the end of the tape. We have, I don't know, 15 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. What are some other issues? We talked about the language requirement in the math department in the past, in the 70s, that you, as associate chairman, would want to talk about.
The 70s, since 1970, what have we been doing? What I have been looking at, major preoccupation through the 70s has been this growth of pre-calculus enrollments signaling poor high school math preparation, which is a very serious thing. It's just teaching the students distorts the whole shape of the department from, I think, it seems to me self-evident that to have a department in which more than half of all the instruction is going into courses which are taught in high school, pre-calculus courses.
Is that the case?
That is the case here. And that's been the price we paid for taking a fairly simple and straightforward approach to the problem of deteriorating instruction. We never tried saying some version of, "Oh my, the students, since we read all the stuff about curriculum improvement, the students clearly must be coming out better prepared in mathematics, and therefore we won't give them any courses."
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, was your comment about the School of Education. I'm very curious how that, you say there's never been very much understanding between the two. Is that a factor here? Would the math department say, look what we're getting from the high schools, why don't you do something about it?
So the School of Education?
Yeah.
No, we would save our breath to cool our porridge. And let's see why. Well, of course, it turns out the School of Education is just like the rest of the college, that the people who are in closest touch with the students are not quite typical of the faculty as a whole. It's true in math, so far as I know. Look at all the departments that have special undergraduate advisors and people with special responsibilities, et cetera.
Yeah, but this is a case of yours. They presumably affect the administrators of high schools, and they train them.
Right.
The teachers.
The people that are involved in training, most closely involved in training of future teachers, are not completely typical of ed school, and they are the part of ed school that we get on with worst. And as I say, we just had a long argument with ed school about not high school training, but training for elementary school teachers. where I mentioned previously, we have some courses specifically for this purpose.
Yeah.
And we found that the ed school people who were most directly involved with teacher training were saying it is actually an old-fashioned retrogressive idea to have any required courses for future elementary school teachers. Future elementary school teachers should be developing their personalities, developing themselves as whole people. There's no such thing as a more or less important subject. You mathematicians are in lobbying for math. Anthropologists might be in lobbying for anthropology. Chinese scholars might be in lobbying for Chinese. All these same, all these are on a level. And that is an argument that I was never very good at holding at my end at, because I felt I was arguing with crazy people. It seems to me, it is plain crazy to make such an assertion, but they nonetheless make it and believe it.
And in the face of this stark case of the students not prepared for even the first year freshman math, that nothing, you can't do anything about it.
Certainly not through ed school.
Who else could you do something about it?
By going straight back to the high schools, which we are trying to do. Other ed school also is all wound up in the new math. They're more involved in the new math. That's a very loaded question. Your average citizen, when they read about declining high school math preparation, says, aha, I knew it, it was the new math, I said so all along. So now you're involved in a long argument about the merits of the new math. Everybody's defensive about that. Indeed, our point of view in this department is just orthogonal, perpendicular, unrelated to the new math point of view. It turns out we want students who to take calculus. We want them prepared to do certain kinds of manipulations, never mind the depth of the understanding of the concepts, etc. New math was all about depth of understanding of concepts. And we're saying we don't care about all that kind of stuff when we are wearing our hats of high school consumers. When we put on our hats of people who advise high schools, we may get we may forget our needs as consumers and say, yes, let's do all the concepts. We're still sorting this out in our own heads after 20 years. Anyway, we're going straight back to the high schools. There's been a revolution in high schools. They used to think of their job as involving the real part of the job was preparing for college, and the rest was not the real part of the job, it's just something they had to do. And during the latter 60s and early 70s, they suddenly changed their own self-image and said the real part of, our real job is serving the students that we've got here. College students, college bound, are in fact a minority. The students who are going to real colleges rather than just the whole broad spectrum of post-secondary are indeed a minority. Then, in the usual fashion, having put college so high and suddenly downgraded it, they downgraded it down to zero. And so, as a matter of fact, we shouldn't think at all about the needs of college students. These being high school counselors, administrators, that sort of people. High school math teachers believe in math and always have, and presumably always will. The structure in which they live just turned itself upside down in its thinking. We're now trying to get them back and saying, we don't ask you to put college number one and everywhere else nowhere. We do ask you, we do agree that you are preparing for lots of different things, but college is a very significant part of your job. Just in terms of numbers, and if we win that battle, then we'll start trying out the battle. Maybe it's even should be accorded a little heavier weight than just the sheer numbers would say. Well, when we win the first battle, we can take up the second.
Is it that these students are badly taught, or haven't had enough, haven't gone far enough?
The remarkable fact is that I can't give you a really authoritative answer to that question. Nobody knows how much they take in high school. And there are at least priests, high school teachers don't seem to really know, because it actually turns out to be a slightly complicated question when you analyze it. So you have to figure, well, how many students are there in high school all told, and what is going to become of these students after they leave? So they don't really know the answer. If DPI, Department of Public Instruction, knows the answer, they won't tell. The university has the answer to this question in its records, at least as regards students who come to this campus. And I'm now involved on a project where, by spending $20,000, we may be able to get it back out of the records again, and then I can tell you.
Well, that'll be the most expensive question I ever asked.
$20,000 to answer a question isn't very much, and...
No, I didn't really I ever asked.
You may have asked other questions without knowing him, that other people never bothered to get the answer to, like, what is the good life?
Anything else? Any other?
Issues of the 70s. Trying to adjust to the fact that when we hire an assistant professor these days, they're now instructors rather than assistant professors. We don't expect to see them around here 10 years down the road.
How much difference does that make in your...
Well, again, the first order differences from our point of view aren't terribly great. We now do indeed rotate people through on a 2-year basis, but it doesn't...
You get rid of them because you don't want to raise their salaries, is that it?
No, because we know that hardly any of them can be promoted to tenure, and... It makes us most uncomfortable to think of keeping them here for 6 years and then not promoting them. You could say we're being nice to ourselves by not living with somebody for 6 years and then canning them, or you could say that we don't feel it's fair to an instructor to keep them around for 6 years, have them put 6 years in one institution, and then tell them goodbye.
Sort of an abortion at an early period.
There's a lot of argument about how this works out and whether how it really does meet the instructor's needs. It's a guy who's put in 6 years in one place and then is let go is going to have a terrible time getting an academic job anywhere. He's going to have to go way, way down in terms of levels of colleges. So if he puts in 2 years at one place and 3 years in another place, or 2 years and 2 years and 2 years, is he better off? Nobody is quite sure. There are reasons why he might be better off. More people know him, more people know his work. He's going to have a richer vita, when he sends it in, more exposure. And the kind of stuff he's done starts at the surface and moves down in. You spend 6 years working on an instructional problem in the math department, you're going to get down in the kind of nuts and bolts which are crucial to us, but which just don't translate to Illinois. Knowing the right person to call on the Madison campus to fix the problem up is essential if you're going to fix problems, but it's not a transferable skill. So maybe these guys are learning more transferable skills. So those are the arguments on the plus side. On the minus side, person has to undergo the trauma of moving every couple of years, finding a new job every couple of years, and maybe all we're doing is just sweeping the difficulties under the rug. I don't suppose that anybody is really going to know until the university system has tried this for about 8 years and somebody has then done a survey and added up the results.
Hey, how many new people have you hired for tenure? How many people have you put on to tenure this year?
We hired one new person from outside at tenure. Two new people. I take that back. This was an extraordinary year. Ennis Morabilis. Two people at tenure. One of them with a fairly heavy MRC involvement.
That protects you a bit, doesn't it?
Well, it's something to talk to the dean about, that maybe he isn't buying a full tenured person. On the other hand, maybe he is, nobody knows, but at least it confuses the issue. It's helpful. He doesn't have to buy the whole thing right there at once. He can put off part of the decision. Before that, last previous tenure person would have been a promotion to tenure about 4 years ago. And,
goodness, that few.
Yeah. About 1970, we stopped hiring people as regular assistant professors, in fact, maybe 69, and started hiring them on a two-year term basis. One of those guys actually got promoted up to tenure. You know, 20 or 30, or I'd have to think a little bit, they've got rotated through and cycled out. That turned out to have been dumb on our part, so we did it 4 years too soon, and when deans finally started getting excited about it, about this whole tenure density issue, we had all these instructors that they didn't think were real people at all, and the rest of our faculty was all tenured, and there are no assistant professors, and they said, you have the worst possible tenure density, you are worse than all other departments, and because we had done it without their having first told us to do it, they didn't believe it had happened. This was a valuable lesson in administration. Never do anything before an administrator tells you, because if you do it on your own, you won't believe in it. And that may illuminate my remarks made at the beginning of the day about instructions in a TA structure.
Yeah, I wondered if there was any connection.
So those, I think, have been the big events of the 70s.
Did the heavy hiring in the 60s, was it good hiring?
Well, that is a nice question, one which deserves a statesmanlike answer. It certainly, in terms of, we could have hired better people, 70s than we hired in the 60s, if we could A, have been smart enough to plan our lives, and B, had lived in an administrative structure, one could plan one's life. And the point of fact is we don't live in such a structure. Here, every year is a law unto itself, and nobody, you ask any administrator
about it.
Because
of the legislature, because of the uncertain.
State legislature, could come in next year with a $25 budget for the University of Wisconsin. It doesn't make any sense to make 10-year plans.
Mm-hmm.
UCLA had a very savvy chairman at that time. Actually, he's at a state university, too. I don't know how he swung it, but he could see, in 1966 how events were going to go, and he held back a lot of positions and spent them out in the early 70s. He was able to do it. We thought about this. We perhaps weren't quite as smart as we were, as he was, but we at least kicked the idea around, and fairly speedily said, that's stupid. If you don't fill the position this year, they'll just take it away next year. And I think we were right. Did we do as good a job of hiring in the 60s as we could have?